A reading from the book of John, chapter 6, verses 1 through 15. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. Jesus went up to the mountain and sat down there with his disciples. Now the Passover, the festival of the Jews, was near. When he looked up and saw a large crowd coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread for these people to eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "6 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little." One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they among so many people?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." Now there was a great deal of grass in the place, so they sat down, about 5,000 in all. Then Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were satisfied, he told his disciples, "Gather up the fragments left over, so that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up, and from the fragments of the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten, they filled 12 baskets. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they began to say, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." When Jesus realized that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself. This is the word of the Lord.
Good evening, Church Without Walls. I am Bruce Hansen. I'm also a Christian. I'm a member of Church Without Walls and part of God's global church. I'm also Bruce Jr., son of Bruce and Barbara. And I have younger siblings, Eric and Pamela. My wife, JJ, is here in the church, as is our daughter, Kayla, and we have another daughter away at college. Many of you know her, and all of my family, in fact. In my little introduction there, I didn't say anything really about me individually, like hobbies, temperament, my job, my favorite music, my favorite foods, etc., as much as I might enjoy talking about myself in front of you all for a half hour. In most cultures on earth today and historically, you're defined first and foremost by to whom you belong. We live in something of a historical and cultural anomaly here in the modern West, where we answer the question, who am I, first individually, in some sort of creative self-expression, and then choose what interest groups I want to belong to that help me feel fulfilled. But most of society and most of humanity has first understood themselves as being defined by the group they are part of, and then you work out your own uniqueness within the parameters, the expectations and obligations of your group that formed you and sustains you. Once way back, this is like, you know, the 1980s or something, I was lost in South Berkeley and wasn't sure what I was doing and needed to just stop and collect my thoughts. And I saw a coffee house, and I love coffee, so I pulled over and I walked inside to Mama Bear's coffee house on Telegraph near Alcatraz. And as I walked, it's a bookstore coffee house, and as I walked through the bookstore part and back to the nice-looking espresso coffee bar in the back, I went up and stood at the counter, and the two employees behind the counter ignored me. Completely ignored me, and I stood there, not knowing what was up. They don't seem closed. I'm the only customer. If I said, "Excuse me, can I get a cup of coffee?" And this woman very gruffly served me a cup of coffee. As I walked out to go, I noticed there was a theme in all the books. It was a feminist bookstore and coffee shop. And as I walked out, I looked at the sign and read the fine print underneath it, "Mama Bears, a bookstore for women." Like it or not, in that moment, I was defined by my gender. I could go back in and say, "But I'm a feminist." But, you know, sometimes our collective identity precedes us, and we don't often like to own that. You know, only, and in our society anyway, only those who are part of majority culture, which in Berkeley it's sometimes a little bit hard to say what majority culture is, but in many parts of the U.S. I would be considered majority culture. And those of us in majority culture get to have the luxury of pretending that we aren't defined by our ethnicity. But those in our midst who are part of an ethnic minority understand very well that they are often defined first and foremost by what people see. And positively and negatively, expectations. But you are put in a box because of your group. And that's not entirely negative, though it can be. That's another talk. And if you are part of an ethnic minority, you probably know the theme of being raised, and your elders, your parents especially, your grandparents, reminding you that whatever you do in public reflects on the community. And you have a responsibility for your collective identity. As Christians, we're not a bunch of converted individuals. We're part of something called the church. And we don't always understand what that means as an identity given by God and to which we are called and in which we are formed. And this passage in John calls us to renew our commitment to being the church of Jesus Christ. Or in the language we've been using for this series in John, the language of, in every passage we look at, what does Jesus reveal? And what is he inviting us into? Revelation and invitation. I think in this passage, Jesus reveals himself as a new leader greater than Moses, who was initiating a new exodus and inviting people to join in this new people of God. Now, to see some of this in this story of the miraculous feeding of the 5,000, we need to understand John's sign language. It's really interesting to me that in John's gospel, he repeatedly refers to Jesus' unusual acts, Jesus' miracles, as signs, which is unique to John's gospel. You know, for those of us who've been around the church, we know there are four biographies of Jesus in the Bible. There's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And they have similarities and differences. They're all the story of our Lord and Savior Jesus, but they're told with unique emphases. And in the Gospel of John, unique to it and different than Matthew, Mark, and Luke, John likes this word signs. He calls Jesus' miracles signs because they point to something else. That is, John reads Jesus' miracles kind of like parables that are meant to teach us something and not just astound us. And Jesus frequently in the Gospel of John gets frustrated at the crowds because they're just wowed by the miracle, but they don't get what it's pointing at. We notice even in this passage, in verse 2 and verse 14, John calls things signs. Verse 2, the crowds are following because of the signs Jesus did in his healings, one of which we studied last week, the healing of the lame man by the pool. John is here calling that a sign. And then in verse 14, John explicitly calls this incident of feeding the 5,000 with the 2 fish and 5 barley loaves a sign. Now, in John's gospel, there are 6 narrated signs. That is, let me back up. In verse 2 of this passage, it says the people saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. But the only sign for the sick that was narrated was just the healing of the lame man by the pool. John only narrates 6 signs. He refers to other ones. It's also interesting there are healings, there's miracles in John that he does not explicitly call signs. So, in a way, what I'm calling us to is to reread John. To read John and pay attention to his sign language. He's trying to teach us something if we'll just read slowly enough and carefully enough. It's interesting, these signs of Jesus in John are all in the first 12 chapters, the first half of John. Once we get through chapter 12, he doesn't use the word again until the very end of the gospel. There's the six narrative signs. I meant to highlight that. We studied the water into wine. In 2:18, Jesus is asked what sign he will give to prove his authority when he cleansed the temple. And he said, the only sign I'll give is destroy this temple, and I'll rebuild it in 3 days. And then John says, by this he was referring to his death and resurrection. So he refers to his resurrection as a sign that he'll rebuild the temple in 3 days. In chapter 4, he heals an official's son who's at the point of death from a distance. And John explicitly calls that a sign. In fact, John starts counting the signs. He says of the water into wine in Cana of Galilee, he said, now this was the first sign that Jesus did in Galilee. Then in chapter 4, when he heals this official's son, John says, and this was the second sign he did in his ministry in Galilee. So John's really calling his attention. Count these people. I'm getting started. One, two, and if you count up, there's six of them. Now, the one in 2:18 is referring forward to his resurrection, but it's narrated, it's referred to there, it's narrated later. Chapter 4, the healing of the official son. Then chapter 5, last week's passage, but the healing by the pool, John calls a sign in 6:2 of this passage, the signs he'd been doing. The fifth one is today's passage. This is sign number 5. And then sign number 6 is in chapter 11, when Jesus raises his friend Lazarus from the dead. Those are the six signs. Okay, I didn't put it up there. I meant to make a slide with chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. Oh, it was before. Ah, thank you. I got out of order. There we go. That's what I meant to have up there. So after the six signs, there's a silence where chapters 13 until 20 are pretty much just a bunch of long speeches by Jesus. He doesn't do any more signs, and John doesn't use the word signs again. But at the very end of John, the evangelist writes this. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and through believing you may have life in his name. In other words, John says, I picked these signs in particular for a purpose, to teach you something about what it means to believe in Jesus. So these are the six signs that he especially wants us to learn from. And I'll just make some real initial, simplistic basic observations. I think the signs go much deeper than this, and we'll delve into this one in particular. But if you even notice a pattern here, the six narrated signs all point to Jesus' death and resurrection. They're all clustered around what the cross means. You notice the first one, the water and the wine, it evokes the Last Supper with wine. And Jesus in that miracle says, my hour has not yet come. His hour in John being when he dies. But then he goes ahead and does the miracle anyway. There's an allusion to the cup of the Last Supper. Jesus' resurrection. There's only resurrection if there's a death first. The healing of the official son makes a specific point to say repeatedly in the story, the man's son was at the point of death. It's a resurrection story. The lame man by the pool. He specifically alludes to him rising up. And then in the commentary after the miracle where Jesus is debating with the religious leaders, he says, I have the power to raise the dead. So there's a resurrection in that story. The feeding of the 5,000. He breaks bread and distributes it. It's an allusion again to the Last Supper and the meaning of Jesus' death. And then the raising of Lazarus, of course, is resurrection. In other words, John's stated purpose that the signs are to lead us to what faith in Jesus means is highlighted by the kinds of signs he narrates. They teach us what the cross and the resurrection mean. So, we get to today's passage. In chapter 6, as John narrates this sign of the feeding, John loads it with allusions to the Exodus. Now, for those of us who haven't been around church a long time, the Exodus happened about 12,000 years before Jesus. It was kind of the charter event in the nation of Israel when the Jews were slaves in Egypt and God raised up a leader for them named Moses who led them against all expectations and probabilities to run for freedom from slavery under the mighty Egyptian Empire. And they got away. And God had some impressive intervention in the process. And they ran out of Egypt into the Sinai desert in the wilderness, where they suddenly realized, we didn't pack, we're not survivalists, we got kids, we got old people, we're hungry and we're thirsty. And they cry out to God and they complain to Moses, what have you done? You've led us out here to kill us. And God prays and God provides water and bread. He feeds them. In the story today in John 6, verses 1 through 15, John makes a point in verse 3 to highlight as Jesus is there on the hill outside of town, kind of in a wilderness kind of place. John highlights in verse 3, now the Passover of the Jews was near. The Passover is the annual celebration where the Jews remember the Exodus and celebrate God leading them out of Egypt. So John hits the atmospherics. Right around the Passover, Jesus is outside of town in a kind of wildernessy kind of place with a mob of people who are getting hungry. Ring any bells? And Jesus miraculously provides bread. You see why at the end of the story it says the people were excited and said, this is the prophet. Who's the prophet? God in Deuteronomy had promised that in the Messianic age, I will send a prophet greater than Moses. That was an expectation of the Jewish people, looking forward to this new Moses. And at the end of this passage in verse 14, it says the people said, is this the prophet? Because they got it. They got what the atmospherics said. Jesus also makes a point of having the disciples pick up the leftovers. He says in the passage, go and collect all the leftovers after he's fed everyone so that nothing may be lost. Another interesting allusion. In Exodus chapter 16, Moses says of the manna, the miraculous bread that comes from heaven, Moses says to the people, don't leave any till the next morning because if you do, it'll perish. It'll be lost. And Jesus here says, collect it all so that nothing will be lost. Well, first, the fact there are leftovers is amazing, right? Here are a bunch of hungry people, and there's leftovers. It shows Jesus' abundance. Second of all, he says, don't leave it for people to carry home in their doggy bags. Collect it up, because we can't have leftovers. Another allusion to Moses. But even more importantly, once they collect all the leftovers, they have 12 baskets full. Israel was constituted of 12 tribes. Again, the symbolism is thick. Jesus is here calling this group a new Israel of some sort in a new Exodus under his leadership. And not only is he a new Moses leading a new Exodus and reconstituting Israel around himself, there's a twist. There's a new kind of bread. And it's not in the passage we read, it's a little bit later in the chapter as Jesus is discussing with his disciples what the miracle meant. And he says in verses 48 to 58, I'll read this. He says, I am the bread of life. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness. See, he's referring back. He knows what he's doing here. And they died. But this is the bread that comes down from heaven so that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever, and the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. The Jews then disputed among themselves, saying, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? So Jesus said to them, very truly I tell you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood have eternal life, and I will raise them up on the last day. For my flesh is true food, and my blood is true drink. Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood abide in me and I in them. Just as the Father sent me and I live because of the Father, so whoever eats me will live because of me. This is the bread that came down from heaven, not like that which your ancestors ate and they died. But the one who eats this bread will live forever. John famously has no communion narrative in the Last Supper. Those of us, again, who have been around church and read the Gospels, you know, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the first three Gospels, all have a scene right before Jesus' crucifixion where the disciples are eating with Jesus. And he takes bread and he breaks it, just like in the story. He gives it to them and says, "This is my body broken for you." We celebrate this at the end of service today and every week here at Church Without Walls. And he takes the cup, and when he had given thanks, he says, "This is the new covenant in my blood poured out for you." John famously does not do that. John has a Last Supper. He narrates the supper where the disciples are together, but John doesn't have Jesus institute this special ceremonial meal with his disciples because John's already done it. He did the cup at the wedding to Cana, wedding of Cana, when he turned water into wine, and he does the bread here. That's why John doesn't put it later. This is John's sign language. He's demanding a lot of the readers. I think also, along with what Pete said in his sermon earlier, I think John knows at least Mark, if not all three of the other Gospels. So he's like, okay, they've done that. I can do something a little bit different now, right? He's riffing on it because he knows what people already are supposed to know. Our shame that we don't, but, you know, we got to read more. In other words, this feeding of the 5,000 story, this new Exodus, this new Moses, tells us what communion's all about. That special bread and wine thing that Christians do at the end of their worship service, or sometimes at the center of their worship service, depending on your tradition. Here at CWOW, along with billions of Christians around the world, we partake in this sign and eat the bread and drink the wine, and in doing this, we affirm our identity with Christ, with one another, and with his church. This sign in John is inviting us into that collective identity, inviting us to be part of that tribe, that people, that ethnos. And I like the traditional word communion. You know, people refer to that as the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, communion. I like the word communion because it highlights the communal aspect of this. It highlights what this story in John 6 emphasizes. And communion is more than community. It is community, but I think community sometimes gets trivialized in our world today to mean, you know, anything from an affinity group, a marketing target, you know, hipsters, some sort of demographic. But all these other, or dare I say, Giants fans. I know if you're checking your phones, I forgive you. These are various communities, right? But this is more than just a community, an interest group. Communion goes deeper. It's more like an ethnic group. It's an identity that's in your blood and in your bones and you can't get away from. We're not just people that share a common hobby, the Jesus Club, like it's the Horticultural Society or a soccer league. We're not just an advocacy group like the East Bay Bicycle Coalition or let alone a marketing demographic of, you know, spandex-wearing bike riders. Such groups connect and interact only in a particular narrow segment of their lives. This Christian identity, this church identity, is a call to whole character and whole life formation. That's why I like communion and identity better than just saying community, though I sure like community and communities. And I kind of summarize one of my takes on what communion is all about and what we are affirming when we come forward and partake in communion around these three words: identity, solidarity, and accountability. When I think on those things, it takes me deeper into this idea of communion. And often, I resist such collective identity. because there's a lot of stuff that Christians do that I think makes me look bad. And I feel like I did at Mama Bear's coffee house. But I'm not like that. But you know what? I gotta own it. I'm a Christian. I'm part of this movement. Often we're just so deeply committed to being individuals, we resist letting a group encumber us. But partaking in the Lord's Supper, if you do that, it commits you to renewing and reforming not just yourself, but the church, because what they all do reflects on you, and what you do reflects on them. You're part of the living tradition that keeps it alive and keeps it reforming. Solidarity means that we're committed to one another's well-being. It means we share life here in this manifestation of the church and with other churches. That we have each other's back. I think this is one of the strengths of Church Without Walls. We do solidarity here. I have been blessed, cared for, encouraged, helped, and supported in so many ways I can't even list them because of this community. That's it. That's communion. That is shared life. And that's what this calls us to. Or to use a different phrase that I think gets at it is the Apostle Paul, a different New Testament.